Okay, well, good afternoon, everybody. My name is Munil Shah. I'm a director of software engineering in the TFS and Visual Studio Online team. I was here yesterday for the kickoff keynote, and as part of that, I talked about how we build software in the cloud cadence and how do we get the code ready to get it deployed into production. In this talk, I'm going to tell you what happens after that code goes into the production, starting from what we did to take an on-premises product like TFS and stood it up in the cloud, and what do we do to kind of keep it running as a service. TFS in the cloud is called Visual Studio Online, and so how do we keep the Visual Studio Online running in the cloud with high availability, high performance, great reliability, etc. So that's the topic for my talk. Oh, I don't need to do that. I can just do this. I always like to start with why give this talk. And so what I did is I went to Bing and searched for service outages and picked up this set of headlines. So let's look at them. So first one says, Google ad serving tool outage caused loss of millions in revenue. So you can see an outage can cause loss of millions of dollars. That's pretty bad. The second one says, CodeSpaces, a lesson in cloud backup. This is a nightmare scenario. This was a company, there was a SaaS provider that provided code hosting in the cloud, much like what we do, TFS and Visual Studio Online. This company went out of business from a single outage. What happened is that they got hacked. Hackers got control of their AWS admin console. They deleted all the data. Not only that, deleted all the backup data, and they didn't have an offsite backup. So they lost all of their data. Along with that, they lost all of their customers' IP with it, and the company went out of business in a single outage. So that's a nightmare scenario. Then you can see this one, Facebook. This is a look what CNN wrote. For about an hour this morning, humans across the world were briefly forced to interact with each other in person. So you get a funny headline like that. Now, this slide is not meant to make fun of our competitors. You can see we are on this slide as well. Azure has, there's a headline for when Azure had a major outage, and we made news on ZDNet when we had an outage back in August last summer. So the outages in the online services are very common, and I hope to tell you sort of what challenges one runs into in running a cloud service, and some things, some practices, some lessons we have learned from dealing with some of these outages and things that we have put in place. So I believe there are three things to running a large-scale cloud service. The first one is your architecture consideration. How does your architecture deal with scale, resiliency, managing cogs, multi-instance, et cetera, deployment, telemetry. The second part is your processes and automation. You want to have your processes as much automated as possible because people make mistakes. Human involvement always causes problems. So I'll talk about that. And then the last, but certainly not the least, is the culture. And culture and processes obviously go hand in hand. You'll see, I'm going to spend most of my time on the architecture and process, but you'll see that when I talk about various things, the culture plays a big role in some of the processes that we have created. So let me start with, this is the TFS 2010 baseline architecture, a classic three-tier web application architecture. We had a set of clients. The clients are your web client. We had a IDE, Visual Studio IDE integrated client, Eclipse client. Those clients sit, they talk to Active Directory for identity. The clients sit in front of the NLB with the load balancer. And behind that, we have an app tier. And then there is a data tier and the build form for running our continuous builds, nightly builds, et cetera. And you can see there is a collection of databases. There is a configuration database. That database holds all the key information, like configuration information, security information, identity information, things like that. And then project collection is each organized, that's the stuff that you store. Your organization stuff is stored in the project collection. An organization can have a dozen or so project collection databases. So you typically, in a setup, you'll have one configuration databases and a bunch of project collection databases, and then there is a warehouse for reporting. Okay, so this was the 2010 architecture. About 3.5 years back, we took this architecture. We decided, hey, we wanted to have a cloud service. So we took this architecture, and we stood it up in the cloud on Azure, using Azure as the cloud OS or cloud provider. And so this is what it looked like. And as you can see, it mapped out to Azure pretty well. So the Active Directory went to AAD and MSA and ACS. The app tier went to the web roles. The jobs, background jobs, they went to the worker roles. There is a build form there. For storage, what we did is we split it into two parts because we have a lot of, if you look at our overall content, there is a lot of content like binaries and source and attachments, et cetera. We didn't want to put it in SQL Azure, so we split the storage into SQL Azure and Azure storage. And the reason is that the SQL Azure is very expensive compared to storage. Storage is a lot cheaper. So we put almost 50% of our content, such as attachments, binary sources, into the Azure storage. So this is what the architecture was for the service. So while it took us only a couple of months to stand up the service, it's taken months to get it really. To make it really cloud ready. And frankly, even today, we are still making architecture changes, we are making process changes. The architecture keeps evolving. So we have something called SPS. It stands for Shared Platform Services. And it contains things like your identity, account, profile, et cetera. That service is still monolithic, one service, one instance, architecture. It's not scaled out. It's not multi-instance. Even our TFS service, which contains key functionality like your version control, work item tracking, all the core functionality, while it's multi-instance, it's not a decoupled architecture. It's not broken up into microservices. So it's still, and so we keep doing additional work to make it a true cloud service. We keep adding code to make it more resilient. We do work to improve COGS and so forth. So I want to tell you some of the things we did to make the service cloud ready. Like I said, we stood it up in only a couple of months, but then there was a lot of work to make it cloud ready. So starting with the code. So we have now, as you can imagine, we have cloud release and we have an on-prem release. 90% of the code between the two is common. We keep one master branch, and then for different releases, we just fork up a release branch, and then we deliver releases out of that. We have actually three delivery streams. The one at the bottom is the cloud service or the VSO service updates. This is the one that we've talked about how we have a 3-week sprint and we deploy at end of 3 weeks. That's that stream. One at the top is the update. So like TFS 2013 update 4 was our last update. And at some point, we stopped doing the updates on the previous version and switch over to the vNext, which would be our TFS 2015. So we do this out of one code base. And there is a layer called shared abstraction layer that is called VSSF, Visual Studio Services Framework. And that basically provides the common functionality between cloud and on-prem. So it handles things like security, configuration, deployment, and so on. And this allows us to basically keep 90% of the code common across on-prem and cloud. So now let's talk about resiliency. Now, in the cloud environment, you have a lot of dependencies. And those dependencies fail all the time. Your dependencies are things that I described on that architecture diagram, things in the Azure environment, but even other things like your load balancer and DNS and the whole networking stack. And these dependencies run on different hardware and different technology stack. And those dependencies fail. They fail often. In fact, they fail during peak traffic, the time where your service is stretched the most, it's got the most constraints. And it turned out, in the early months of standing up the service, every time a dependency failed, we failed. And if you're, you know, each dependency is supposed to provide you 3 nines of availability, but imagine if each of them is only doing 3 nines, well, you can never do 3 nines unless you built really good resiliency in the service. And so in the initial months, in fact, those services were not, some of this dependency were not even providing 3 nines, so we could never meet the 3 nines availability goal ourselves. You know, we used to track sort of our live side incidents, and we track whether the incident is caused by a bug in our code or a bug in a dependent service code. And the first 18 months, most of the time we failed because there was a bug in the dependent service. And of course, we were not resilient enough to manage that. So we did a lot of work to shore up resiliency. It started with just the basic things like retries. You know, if something fails, don't just give up, you know, retry. Now, it turns out if you are too aggressive with the retries, that causes problem. You need to have the right backoff in place. The other thing is this concept called graceful degradation, which you hear about in the services space. And the idea is that if in a distributed environment, if a component fails, then it should only impact the functionality of the product that it's responsible for. So for example, you know, we had this thing called profile service that stores users' display name and avatar. It had a hiccup with the Azure storage service, and it brought down the entire shared platform service. We had a major service-wide outage. So we said, no, we can't allow that. Let's take the profile service out of shared platform service and make it a separate independent service. So we started taking a lot of these non-critical services out of the core critical services. Chaos Monkey is a concept that you might have heard of. You know, you just randomly bring down some dependencies and see how your service does, whether it handles that gracefully or it just dies. So we started doing that kind of testing. A circuit breaker pattern, this is a pattern in the code that you write where it detects an overload condition, and let's say there is a dependency that's slow and so suddenly there is an overload. So it detects that, and then it would send in an error code back to the caller saying, hey, just back off or slow down or try again in few more minutes or something like that. So it's a way to manage overload condition in the service. The second thing that can happen is that the scarce resources will exhaust. So the scarce resources, by that I mean things like your threads, your memory, your CPU, your connection pool, network ports, things like that. And again, these things will fail during peak traffic, just when you don't want it to fail. We had a number of outages involving just something, runs out of the resource that we are trying to acquire, including network port. And these are really, really hard problems. They are hard problems to anticipate, hard problem to debug, hard problem to recover. And what our best strategy here was just add tremendous amount of telemetry. Telemetry to monitor everything. Monitor CPU, memory, disk, I/O, thread pool, connection pool, network ports, and understand the pattern of usage during different time. The other thing we did is we started segregating those, like I said, non-critical services should never run away with critical resources and cause a major problem on the service. So understanding the resource usage, resource governance model, that became important. And the last thing is building a disaster recovery plan. Now, this involves two things. You need to be thinking about two kinds of disaster. One is where a cluster or a stamp goes down or a data center goes down, and you have a high available a service where you can take, where you have another instance of the service running in another data center or another cluster, or either a passive or an active, and you're able to fail over. So that's one scenario. The other scenario is like that code space scenario, where either maliciously or accidentally, either through a bug or a person, goes and deletes some data or corrupts some data. You need the ability to recover from that. And what I found with building disaster recovery plans, and I've done this now, three times, is that just building a plan or building an architecture is never good enough. You have to exercise that plan regularly, and you have to automate that plan, because otherwise what happens is that when it comes time to really exercise the plan, and you've never done it before, the first answer you get from your operation or service delivery says, no, I'm not going to do it because I don't have any confidence this is going to actually work. And so just when you do it, they don't do it. And so the only way to force that is to just every month or every couple months, you just go and fail over and you build that capability in the service itself. scale. So, you know, the simplest way to scale is to take that architecture that I showed you and then just create a multiple stamps or multiple instance of that. So, like, hey, let's create one for each customer. And that would be an easy way to scale. Of course, that's a very, very expensive way to scale. So we did scale in two ways, scale up and scale out. So first was scale up using multi-tenancy. The first thing we needed to do was build multi-tenancy. And the first place we needed to build multi-tenancy was in the databases. Remember, in the on-prem system, each organization has its own collection database. If we did the same thing in the cloud, where each customer gets its own database, it would be very expensive, because SQL Azure, a database, even the cheapest one, it still costs a couple of dollars per month. And our business model is that the large number of customers on our service are actually free, because we provide 5 free users per account. We provide stakeholder licenses, which are free. And so from business model perspective, simply that wouldn't work. So we had to build multi-tenancy in a database. So we put multiple tenants in a database through partitioning. And obviously that raises the question about how do you manage security. So we did a lot of work to make sure that a data from one partition never leaked into the second partition. And there were, you know, we did a lot of testing by taking the partition down and seeing whether and basically setting an exception or alert whenever somebody tries to access across the partition. So we did that. Now, SQL Azure has its own multi-tenancy model, where what it does is it packs a whole bunch of databases on a single logical server. So we would have this thing called noisy neighborhood problem. And we had a lot of outages. We go to SQL Azure and say, oh, what happened? Well, you just had a neighbor who was exhausting all the resources on the same server, and you ran out of resources yourself. So, and they just call it, well, you got a noisy neighbor, deal with it. So that was obviously a problem. Then SQL Azure came out with this concept called Premium DB, where you get allocation on a server. They guarantee a particular allocation on a server. So we moved to that that database. It was a little bit more expensive, but it turned out to be a better performing a database. So we moved to that. But the key thing with the multi-tenancy is that you have to really understand your resource usage and resource governance model, and you have to protect your core resources. So this worked fine. We went up to about a million customers, million accounts. And then we started hitting limits of the scale-up architecture. In fact, the big revelation came when we did a major launch, actually back in November 2013, when we announced Visual Studio Online as the new brand name. This was a launch we had been working on for months. And the idea was to, on the day of the announcement, Brian Harry was going to go up the stage demo and talk about the new brand, new commercial terms. On that day, we were supposed to launch this major new brand. We had everything, we had been working on it for months. Everything was hidden behind the feature flag. 5 a.m. in the morning, like, we had the whole team super excited, ready to turn the whole thing on, and we turned on the feature flags, and the service went, And Brian's in New York, and he's frantically calling me and others in the team, like, hey, what the hell is going on? Bring it back up. I'm supposed to go on the stage. it turned out we just couldn't bring the service back up. And finally, we told Brian, sorry, the service is down. It's not coming back up. So he actually did the demo using PowerPoint instead of showing the demo live on the service. But that became a real inflection point for us to go do multi-tenancy. Multi-instance scale-out architecture. It was already in our plan, but we prioritized it. It was, we were going to work on it a little bit later. We said, no, we need to go work on it right now, because we cannot have a single outage take down the entire service and all million-plus customers on the service. So we built multi-instance support. So now service has about, we have six scale units. So we have presence in six different data centers, including one data center in Europe, and the other data centers are in US. And now every 3 to 4 months, we add another data center. We'll add more in different regions, probably more data center within Europe and so on. Okay, let's talk about deployment. Deployment is another big challenge with the services. It's a trickiest problem to deal with. On-prem, this is relatively easy. You schedule a deployment over the weekend. You bring the server down. Upgrade the binaries, upgrade the schema, bring the servers back up. Everything is good. Well, with an online service that's running 24/7, how do you do that? You can't take the service down, because even during the lowest hours of usage, like if you look at Sunday afternoon, we still have thousands of users on the service. So there is no way we can bring the service down. The other issue you have is that it's a highly distributed environment. You've got multiple services, you've got multiple components. They all need to coexist at the same time, potentially on different versions. You can't update all of them together. So we have something called a servicing engine that handles all this magic. But essentially what it does is there is a concept of a contract between two components that you're going to update in a sequential manner. And what you do is when you do the updates, you either maintain the contract between the two components, or you introduce a new contract, but you don't retire the old contract until both components are updated. And then you can go back and remove the contract. So that's kind of how we handle online update. It's fully automated. We use our release management tool to do the deployment, and it deploys it across all six scale units, and it deploys it in a particular sequence. The second thing we do with deployment is this concept called progressive disclosure. It's an idea about sort of disclosing the features or the deployment in a progressive manner, and we do it in two ways. One is called staging. So we stage our deployment. So the way we do it is when the code is ready to go into production, we'll deploy it to our first scale unit called SU0. This is the scale unit on which we are running our own code. So if something goes wrong, we are the first one to detect it, because our service, our team is hosting our own engineering system on that instance. And then we deploy it to other scale units, starting with the one that has the least number of customers and so on. So that's one tactic we use. The other one is called feature flags. And the idea is that we have this ability to enable or disable features at runtime without even a code or deployment. So the way we work is that at the end of third week, everything that's checked in gets deployed. Whether that feature is ready or not, everything gets deployed. So that's the message to the team. You must deploy whatever you finished at the end of third week. If a feature is not ready, it gets hidden behind a feature flag. And then you can turn on the feature flag when the feature is ready. We use this mechanism for a variety of uses. One is this, what I just described. But other one is it helps us do progressive disclosure. So if there is a feature that's a brand new feature, we want to first just try it out internally, give it to a few accounts internally, then maybe a handful of customers. Or maybe if there's a feature that we want to not disclose until a major announcement, like the one I was talking about earlier, we keep that behind a feature flag, and then now we don't do a disclosure just literally an hour before an announcement. We do it maybe a 12-hour before, so we have some time to recover from a failure if there is one. But that's the other mechanism we use for deployment. All right. So with that last bit on the architecture side of things, now I'm going to move on to processes. So the first thing was we needed a 24/7 monitoring system that ran reliably all the time. So we built a monitoring system. The problem was the monitoring system was less reliable than the service itself. So the monitoring system would go down more often than the service. In fact, it would go down the same time the service goes down. So when you need it the most, because you need your monitoring system to find out if there is a problem, you need to collect data, and that's when the monitoring system is also down. Not only that, when we have an outage, there'll be a deluge of data, and the system just cannot keep up with the data, and it will take hours to catch up. So when we need the data, we don't have it. So we said, this is unacceptable. We spun off a feature team. We said, you own the telemetry pipeline. You make it reliable. It needs to be a completely separate from the service. It needs to have multiple resiliency paths, and it must work all the time. And if you're going to get behind, I need you to don't spend time catching up. I need you to keep the current data flowing and then catch up later. So we built a lot of good stuff in the telemetry system to do that. So now our telemetry system collects very rich data that allows us to do both real-time and latent analysis. It's got a notion of a hot path, warm path, cold path, and depending on the urgency of the data, it flows through different channels. It has this notion of critical channels versus non-critical channels. So it's a fairly sophisticated thing. And from that, we build all kinds of visualizations. So you might ask, what do we collect? What kind of telemetry we collect? Well, the simple rule is just collect everything. Our message to the team is instrument everything, collect everything, visualize everything. So you can see, like, we collect activity logs, traces, KPIs, job history, customer intelligence data, business intelligence data, perf counters, you name it. We collect telemetry about our dependencies, our external things external to our service. And then we visualize all that telemetry through dashboards, you know, through DevOps reports, the reports that go out to our engineering team as well as the service delivery team that they monitor and they look at every hour or so. We use it to debug live-side issues. We use it to run experiments. We use it to run audits. So telemetry is sort of the lifeblood of running the live site. And as you can see, you can look at the growth of the telemetry. Just in 6 months, the growth of the telemetry data has grown six times, just in 6 months. So, you know, this is a constant battle that my telemetry feature team deals with, just managing the growth of the data. And remember, we are just a SaaS service. We are not like a big cloud provider or, you know, Azure Compute or Azure Storage or Bing. That would have data that would be orders of magnitude more than this. But, you know, at this point, we feel pretty good about the kind of telemetry we collect. So let me give you some examples of the things that we collect. So the first one is activity log. What is an activity? It logs about every web request made against the VSO service. Every incoming request from a customer is logged. And we log various properties like how long that activity was run, how many times, against which account, and so on. And then we classify it under whether it was whether that command passed or failed. We also set thresholds, like each command must pass within, say, 10 seconds, and if it finish within 10 seconds, then call it a slow command. And we aggregate all of that data, slow commands, failed commands, and we use that to trigger alerts or measure availability, for example. So the graph shows a sudden spike in slow commands, and so this would trigger an alert and require an investigation. We'll go and figure out why that happened and go fix that. The other one is traces. So we use ETW for tracing, and traces are used for logging error states in the code or logging any states that might come useful in debugging later. Because remember, this is a 24/7 service. You cannot do live debugging. So if you have a transient problem that, you know, just come and go, well, you don't have the option to catch it in real time, so the traces come very handy. Or you may have a problem for which the root cause started, you know, well before it showed up in some other part of the system, so you need to be able to trace back in time and go find where it started. And traces come super, super handy. Now, the problem with this is that the problem we faced, at least earlier, is that the developers would, you know, you have to instrument the code to have the traces on. Now, the developers would just not instrument the code. Their mindset was, let me get this feature out, and then I'll add instrumentation later. Well, guess what? The feature is out into production. There is a live site, and you don't have the instrumentation. So we had to change this culture and mindset that no, you must instrument when you put that code into production, because you can't do it later. So the graph shows, you know, again, the example in each of these slides, I'm just trying to show what we caught. So this is an example where a particular trace point, in a trace count just increased suddenly, and so this would require an investigation. This would fire an alert, and our team will go and investigate this. Perf counters. So we use perf counters for debugging as well as performance analysis. And so we measure things like CPU, memory, disk, I/O, et cetera. And the example shows that there was a memory leak that happened right after the deployment. So again, it will show up in a graph like this, and we'll catch it. Now, with a graph like this, one of the challenges with perf counters is that you really have to understand the usage pattern. So let's say you do a deployment on Friday, and this is one of the reasons we don't do deployment on Friday. I'll tell you in a second. Say you do a deployment on Friday. Friday, the traffic is relatively low, and so everything looks good. And then everybody goes home. Weekend passes. Everything is fine on the weekend. You come back Monday morning, 6 a.m., boom. 6 a.m. is where it turns out that our peak traffic starts at 6 a.m. because this is the time when European customers are on, our East Coast customers are on, and the West Coast customers starting to come on. So between 6 a.m. and 10 a.m., I'm talking about Redmond time, is when the peak traffic. And so you come Monday morning, and you know the CPU was running fine, 30, 40% on Friday, and boom, you're at 70, 80%. And if you have a bug with that new deployment, you've got a live site issue to deal with first thing Monday morning. So our team knows how to normalize the data point based on traffic. So if they know that, okay, well, if you're at X percent with this traffic, then you're going to be at Y percent with this other traffic, and they can detect that. The other thing is, if you have a slow decay in the memory, it's very, you know, so what happens is that you lose, let's say there is a memory leak, and after a while the service just fails over. Something like that is easy to catch with the telemetry that I'm showing here. Then we also track what's going on outside of our service. So, for example, network. Now, network problems are the hardest one to deal with, and I've dealt with a number of them. They are very hard to debug. They show up in a bizarre way. You may have 100 different nodes, and one of the nodes is having a network problem, and you try to debug it at the application layer, at different layers, until you realize that the problem is, you know, downstream somewhere in the network. So we have this thing called ping mesh. It's, you know, it basically pings each node combination and maintains a baseline of network connectivity. So when we have a problem, as you can see in this chart, there is a column with all cells in red. It becomes very easy to spot the problem. Like, okay, well, that node is having a connectivity issue. And it makes a very easy conversation with our networking team, because our networking, every time we have a live site and we say, we think there is a networking problem. It's like, no, there is no networking problem. We haven't seen anything. There is nothing, we haven't seen any alerts. And so, like, the onus is on us to prove that there is a networking problem. Now we just show this. Look, this node is having a problem. It cannot talk to any of the other nodes. There is a proof. Collecting network trace is very clumsy. It takes a lot of time. So something like this comes very handy. All right. So we talked about how we instrument everything. We have a monitoring system. But the failures in the cloud environment are very common. The failures happen all the time. Storage goes down, your SQL goes down, network goes down, hardware goes down. So we follow a core principle that you want to fail fast, detect fast, and recover fast. Why fail fast? Remember I told you that the way we deploy is that we deploy to scale unit zero, which is our own instance, and then we deploy to other scale units. So if you're doing a new deployment, if there is a problem, I want it to fail on my first instance before it gets spread into all the full cloud environment, because its recover becomes much harder. So that's fail fast. The detect fast and recover fast is all about speed, because you want to get the service back up running. And the key to detection is alerting. You know, having really good alerting is key to detection. So the first message to the team was, instrument everything. Just collect all the telemetry you can. The second message to the team was, set alerts. Set alerts on everything. Anything that indicates a problem, or something that indicates a leading, something is a leading indicator of problem. Set alerts. So we have an alerting system that's optimized for fast and precise detection. So while alerting is good, the poor alerting or bad alerting can make your DevOps really mad. Because if you got an alert that fires at 2 a.m., and the guy comes on phone or on the bridge and finds that it was a false alarm, the person is going to get mad. So poor alerting is a problem. And there are multiple factors that cause poor alerting. The first one is just you got redundancy in the alerting system, meaning you have a problem down at the networking layer, and your alerts are firing in all your subservices. And so there are like 5 or 10 different alerts going out, and you're dealing with those alerts individually, and you're calling 5 or 10 different people. The first person you should be calling is the networking guy. And of course, you know, if they cannot resolve the networking issue, you need some backup plan to maybe fail over the service or whatnot. But your first reaction is not to react to those 5 or 10 different alerts, is to deal with the problem at source. The second thing is, how do you set right thresholds? You know, this was another challenge we ran into, that let's say you have an alert on your database growth. You set it too low, and you're going to wake somebody up middle of the night to deal with a problem that is several days, you know, out, meaning you don't need to deal with it right away. Or you set it too high, and now you don't have enough time to recover from it. So what we found is that the right way to set threshold is to understand the rate of growth of a database or whatever you're trying to alerting on, and the time required to recover, so that you have sufficient time for somebody to come online and take care of the problem. The third issue was stateless alert. So this is an alert that keeps bombarding you for the same issue, you know, and that just causes unnecessary noise. So we set some goals for the team. We said, well, every alert should be actionable and should present a real issue in the system. The second thing is, the alert should create a sense of urgency. So the false alerts dilute that. So as I mentioned earlier, if you get lots of alerts at 2 a.m., they're all false alerts, guess what's going to happen? Next time, the person is not going to pick up the phone, or is going to take his own time to come online. So what we did is we started reviewing the alert volume weekly in our live site review. We have a weekly live site review. So the team would bring list of all the alerts, and they'll put alerts into these buckets. The buckets, there are noisy alerts and good alerts. So I already mentioned what a repeat alert is. There'll be non-actionable alerts, like an alert that fired during deployment. We know that when we do a whip swap, we get this kind of alert. Well, no action was taken. So of the 1,000 or so alerts we look at every week, we found that, well, of the 1,000, there were probably 980. They were just bogus alerts that we didn't do anything with it. We just kind of, it's just a noise that we are processing. There are only 20 meaningful alerts. And the meaningful alerts are where you took some action, either you followed a troubleshooting guide and resolved the issue, or you actually had to engage an engineer or call somebody to deal with the problem. So while we did this work, we classified, there was still a problem. We still couldn't manage the noise. We couldn't bring it down. So we implemented something called health model. And the way it works is this. On the far right, those dots are the alerts. So green means good, and red means there is an actual alert. And each alert has a naming scheme. So there is a namespace. For example, the alert, the top alert is ai.services.apm.datasources.events. So we did this work. Then the dots with the halo around it, the first two columns, they are the actual components of the system with a feature team behind it. So now the way it works is that, so let's say there are three alerts that are firing. There's the first one is a memory alert, the second one is a performance alert, the third one is also a performance alert. The two of them are critical and one is not critical. They are all mapped to a namespace, and there is a correlation engine that says, oh, wait a minute, all these three alerts are mapped to this one component, so when the first alert fires, I'm only going to call the person responsible for that component. In this case, it's APM. When that person comes online, he has a visual view of all the alerts that fired in the system and can say that, oh, all those three alerts are related to the same issue, and where I need to work on is that at the APM node. Because the dealing with live side is like there is a fog of war. I mean, you come online and there's so much information, and you know, finding your right target or the right piece of information to look at versus wading through maybe an inbox full of lots of alerts and trying to make sense out of that, a tool like this is a real time saver. And as you can see, in fact, there is an example. We brought down the noise from 928 alerts per week to 22 just by implementing something like this. Oops, I have a build here. So now the alert fires, and we need to call somebody. So how did we engage a DRI? A DRI is a designated responsible engineer, somebody who is on call to deal with live site problems for that shift or for that week. Now, we had a system earlier. This is described by these four boxes. The second box of is, you know, first is, you know, there's an alert. Second box is vSols. This is our 24/7 vendor team that just manage those alerts. And their job was to, within 5 minutes, when an alert fires, they need to take an action. They need to troubleshoot, they need to decide, they need to look at a troubleshooting guide. Each alert has a troubleshooting guide. They look at and say, what do I need to do? Is this a real problem, or do I take some steps, or do I call an engineer? And so then they would call global DRI and the feature team DRI, which I'll describe in a second. But once we put that other system in place, where we had the health model and the alert volume came down, we said we no longer need to have a 24/7 team like that, a tier one team like that. Their job was to just manage the alert volume. We can now call the engineer directly. So we implemented something called autodialer. And so when alert fires, it would automatically call the person. And again, it's using the same correlation engine that I showed you in the health model. So it knows whom to call. In that case, it would call only the person who's responsible for that APM node. And the screenshot shows how we configure this thing. So there is, for every node, there is a primary and a secondary DRI. So in case of the primary doesn't respond, then you have a secondary. And then if they don't respond, then there is a whole chain of escalation that take place, including I can get a call if nobody responds. In fact, you know, I have a Windows Phone. On Windows Phone, we have this thing called quiet hours. So a lot of people would set the quiet hours at night and say, okay, well, you know, I need peaceful sleep, so I'm going to set the quiet hours. Guess what happens? When this thing calls, it's not going to punch through, and so it will just start escalating, and the call will go all the way to maybe Brian Harry. So we told the teams, like, hey, if you're on a DRI duty, you cannot set quiet hours. But in addition, we had to configure this thing to call people twice, because, you know, you can punch through the quiet hours if you call again. So, I mean, simple things like that we have to kind of think about. All right, so I mentioned the global DRI. So what is this? This is a team of a full-time engineers, that service delivery engineers, that we have across the globe. And we have them in 5 different locations. We have somebody in Australia, somebody in India, in Europe, in US East Coast, and US West Coast. And we were lucky that we already had our escalation engineers. These are highly trained support engineers who've been dealing with TFS for a long time and with a very deep understanding of the product. We were able to just recruit them. They were already spread out across the globe, so we were able to recruit them in our team to build this global DRI team. And the way it works is that, this graph just shows how we get the 24/7 coverage. The middle column is the UTC time. So you can see we get coverage throughout the day. The engineer in Australia and India, because their time overlaps significantly, they're able to share the DRI shift. So they take a DRI duty every alternating week, so which is nice, because the other person get a break for a week and want to plan vacations, then they can do that. The same thing with the person who's in Europe, is in Switzerland now, and the US East Coast, they're able to share their DRI duty also, because there is a nice 5-hour overlap from 7 a.m. to 1 p.m. on East Coast time versus 1 p.m. to 6 p.m. in Europe. And then Seattle team is big enough, so they can just rotate that responsibility among themselves, and they can also have a larger DRI shift. All right, so now the service is down. When the service goes down, it becomes a job number one for the entire team. I mean, we have this thing called live site first. Doesn't matter what you're doing. You stop doing that, and you respond to, there is a bridge, there is a conference call that gets spun up, everybody jumps on the call. I've had a number of cases where I'm sitting in a review, I'm doing an exec review, and my service delivery manager would either text me, or I get an IM, and I would just stand up and walk and just say, sorry, there's a live site issue, I need to go. And people would understand that. Likewise, when we call a DRI, if you're on the DRI duty, we expect that you, no matter where you are, you could be at a movie or it could be in a restaurant, we expect you to be available within 15 minutes to get on a computer and be able to respond to the issue. And so when you're dealing with the live site, the core rules of engagement are speed, discipline actions, and automation. And speed is obvious. We want to kind of take care of the problem as fast as possible. Discipline action is something that we learned over time. we would spin up a bridge, there'd be a lot of people on it, and there's all kinds of chatter going on. There's so much going on that lifesite bridge, because you are trying to collect information. You got all this telemetry. Telemetry is not telling you clearly what the problem is or where the problem is. You have a responsibility to communicate. You have to communicate to the external customers, to internal customers, to partners. You need to coordinate. You need to get the right engineer on the call. For every action, you may have multiple options, so you need to weigh their options. So being very disciplined about how you approach that is the job of an incident manager, the person who's managing the incident. And so that is key. So and when you're dealing with that kind of environment, I think automation is your friend. And so we try to automate as much as we can. So this is an example of an automation that comes handy. This is an auto dumper. So the problem was this. Let's say we are seeing some kind of a spike on a CPU. The problem is that by the time you get an alert, you call somebody, the person comes online, and let's say RDP is into a box, and looks at the problem is gone. And you try to wait for it again, and the same thing can happen, or a problem may never happen again. So we implemented something called auto dumper that triggers on an event and then collects the dump. So now, if it's a transient problem, no problem. We can have an engineer go look at the dump after the fact and still troubleshoot the issue. The other example is automated communication. So the problem is this. As I mentioned, when we have a lifesite issue, we need to communicate. Our goal is that within 15 minutes of detecting an incident, we want to get an advisory out to all our customers saying, hey, we know there is a problem. We understand what it is, or we're trying to understand what it is. Here are things we are doing. Here are things that you can do to mitigate it or to work around it. And that communication needs to be updated constantly. Likewise, we need to communicate internally to our leadership team, to people who are responsible for the service and so on. And the problem was that doing this manually is very problematic for many reasons, because each engineer may do the communication differently. And so the language may not be the same. The way you write it, this may not be the same. You may miss out critical information like which data center is impacted or which service is impacted. And so you used to have a problem where people would just completely forget to communicate. And then we ask the question, hey, wait a minute, you have been working on this incident for last hour and you haven't informed the customer. So we implemented this automated communication. So it's a tool that allows us to just pick from an existing template. The incident manager would just pick a template because some problems are fairly common, make quick modification, and it fills out all the other information correctly, and then off you go and you send a communication, and then it communicates across multiple channels. Like it will update our service status, it will put a blog advisory, it will update Twitter, it will send an internal email. Again, you might think this is a small thing, but it's a big time saver when you're dealing with LiveSite. All right, so how do we communicate to our customers about incidents? So there are multiple ways we do it. The top right corner shows the advisory we post on the visualstudio.com. If you go there, if you click on the support, you will see an advisory like this. So green means service is up and running, it's fine. You know, yellow means it's having some issues, and red means it's down. And then you can click, click Visual Studio Service blog. When you click on that, you get a blog like this, and this is where we keep providing more details on the issue. We keep providing updates and, some actions that the customer can take. Likewise, on Twitter is another place people go to. A lot of customers just go to Twitter to either report a problem or to learn what's going on, because other customers are also active on Twitter. So we would update Twitter also with the latest service status. Now, if it's a serious issue, if it's a major issue, then Brian Harry would post a blog describing what happened, what caused the problem, what was the trigger, what was the root cause, what we learned from it, what actions we are taking. So there's like a full transparency around mistakes, around what we learned from it, and not just that, but what actions we are going to take to prevent that mistake from happening again. Now, you might think this could backfire because now we are just washing our laundry in front of our customers. But the customers love this because they see this transparency. They see that this team is very honest about their mistakes. But more importantly, we are holding ourselves accountable when we post an advisory like this because we are listing the actions that we are going to take. So if we have another incident that shows that perhaps we didn't quite follow up on all the things that we said we would follow up on, people can call us on because this becomes a public record. And so it, transparency is great, but it also holds our team accountable. All right, so all this is good. There is transparency, there is a process to manage lifecycle, et cetera, but we still, there is a promise to our customers and promises around availability. So we, just like many services, we promise 3 nines of availability. And yes, this SLA is backed by financial guarantee. So if you go up to the Azure place where they keep the financial SLA guarantee, you can find a section on VS Online. It says, if you fail to meet this guarantee, we'll credit you, you know, and there is a formula, et cetera. But really, internally, if you ask my team how we think about this, we are never concerned about 3 nines. Our concern is, how do we get to 100%? So we are obsessed about that missing 0.1%. When we look at our data, we look at what happened in that 0.1%. How did we not get to 100%? What's missing? What's causing us to stay below 100%? That's the internal mindset we keep. And therefore, we never internally worry about 3 nines or SLA because our bar is much, much higher than that. Now, being obsessed about availability starts with getting your availability computation right. And you won't believe how many people just don't compute this correctly. We ourselves have gone through 3 levels of sophistication in measuring availability and the computation model, each time making it harder and harder on us and consequently better for our customers. So in its first incarnation, the way we measured availability was using outside-in synthetic test against a specific account. We run a set of functional tests, and based on that, we computed. It was easy to set it up, and that's how we got going when we set up the service. But we quickly realized that that had a very limited coverage because you're testing against a very specific account with a very specific set of tests, and you're leaving all this other functionality of the product out of the computation. So we left that model behind fairly quickly. And then we came up with this another model that measured our availability based on that command health that I showed you earlier. So it would track all the past and failed commands. It would also track commands that perform slowly. We'll aggregate all the slow and failed commands, and we divide by total commands, and we compute availability. So now you've got a fairly comprehensive view of the service. We are measuring everything, and we are holding a much higher bar for ourselves. And that model worked great for quite some time, actually. But we found limitations with that model also. And the limitation was that as the service grew, and as we had more and more customers, you know, well over 2 million, the denominator, the total number of commands executed, became so large that if there was an incident that was narrow or impacted fewer customers, it didn't actually register. It didn't show up in our computation. So we said, no, we need to raise the bar even more. We need to push our team even more. We really need to be sensitive to exactly the experience our customers are facing. Don't get, you know, caught up on the numbers. You can easily produce 3 nines, but that's not the idea. The idea is to have a fantastic customer experience. So we came up with a third model that's even more sensitive to real customer experience. And so what we did is we started grouping those commands by time slices. We grouped them by, you know, 5-minute interval, and then aggregate it by accounts. So instead of aggregating it across the entire service, we started aggregating it by account. And we computed availability using that. It's a fairly elaborate math. I mean, there is a blog post, again, on this that describes how we compute this. But the net result of this is what's shown on the graph. So you can see the dotted line at the top is showing the availability using the old computation model, meaning the phase two model. And so there is a particular window here where we are actually having an issue with the service, and yet that old computation is showing us that we are meeting 99.9, no problem. With this new model, which is the dark black line, it shows that no, the availability has actually gone down. And it's actually gone down all the way to 0.88% at one point and hovering around 0.9294. So as you can see, this suddenly we were looking green all these months on our availability chart. All our availability chart turned red. And so we had to do more work to kind of make it even more resilient, make it more available to again hit 3.9s. Our customer's bag of sand. I stole this headline from, again, Brian's blog. And he talks about this notion that you don't treat customers in an aggregate. You know, customers, each customer has its own individual experience. It's like a bag of sand has a lot of grains, and you don't treat as one big bag. You can inspect each grain separately. And so what we do is we track availability in aggregate. Sure, fine, that's good, 3.9s. And like I said, we're not even concerned about 3.9s. Our goal is to be at 100%. But we also track availability by accounts and by customers. So we look at availability of our top customers, availability of customers who are having the lowest availability. And then here, what I've highlighted is this red zone where customers are having lower availability. And so we'll go and find a customer who's having a poor availability. As an example, we found a customer, we sent an email or we reached out to that customer on a call and said, hey, we think you're having a bad experience. Is that true? The customer was like completely surprised, like, wow, Microsoft called me and said, yeah, you know, our queries are kind of running slow, and but the problem wasn't big enough for us to call support. I mean, we're just going to wait and see how this thing went, but I'm glad you called. So let's troubleshoot. And we looked at their account, and they're large, you know, they're basically, they had some complex queries and large number of customers. Anyway, we troubleshot their problem and then fixed the problem, and the customer was thrilled. So we have this kind of practice where we are not focused on just the availability in aggregate. We are focused on individual customer experience. All right, so what happens is once a week, then we get together and we look at how the last week went. And so this is called a weekly live site review. This is attended by basically senior engineering leaders in the team, all engineering managers, directors. We get together and we look at the view of the live site for the past week. And the focus of this meeting is not, you know, being critical of the team or passing blame. This is all about continuous improvements. How do we get better? And the meeting is attended by leaders of the organization because we want them to represent what happened, not some engineer in the team. So the types of things we look at is availability, reliability, performance. You know, we collect all kinds of metrics, so we look at that. The big focus of this meeting is to look at the live side incident postmortems. These postmortems are presented by the engineering manager, not an engineer. By the engineering manager, so they write up the postmortem and they come and present it. And the reason we do it that way is because, first, we want to be extremely self-critical and open in our conversation. And the second thing is a lot of the actions we take, they are not tactical actions, they are very broad-based actions, and we want engineering managers to be there. We practice what we call five whys, and the idea is that you keep asking this question, why? Why did this happen? Why did that happen? Why did that happen? Until you get to the real root cause, such that we can identify action at each layer of the stack versus just fixing it at the superficial layer. And then the lessons learned from this exercise are shared with the entire team. So if we learn something that, hey, we had a major outage, there are some five things we learned, how to deal with this, how to avoid this kind of patterns in the code, in the architecture, including process improvements, all those things then we end up sharing with the team. From this, so anyways, let me show you the RCA template that we use. It's a special WIT that we have created for this. And it's got different sections. So there is the first section that just describes the incident, the person who was assigned to what, you know, the data center it was in, the instance it was in. Then this section captures the entire timeline from when the incident started, who took action first, who engaged the DRI, when did we do the communication, when the issue got resolved, and so on. So we captured the complete timeline, so we can measure things like time to detect, time to mitigate, time to communicate, etc. Then This one has additional RCA details. Was it a repeat issue? What was the error category? If it was a partner issue, you know, what's a partner ticket number? Things like that. And then there are additional tabs. So those are just the standard fields. And then additional tabs. So the impact describes what happened, how many customers were impacted, what was the availability impact, what steps we took to recover from it. That's the mitigation. What was the RCA? What was the root cause? Now, a lot of times what I find is that when people talk about root cause, it's not the root cause, because sometimes there is a root cause and then there is a trigger. So a service going down because of, you know, database having an error, well, that's just a trigger. The root cause is that the service doesn't have a resiliency built in to deal with the database failure. So kind of understanding the difference between the two is super important. And the problem management is where you list down all the actions you're taking to prevent the issue from happening again. The idea is, how do we prevent this from happening again? That's the core that we're trying to get to. And then all those problem management items get rolled up in what we call a problem management report. And the idea is that we don't want to look at this incident in isolation. We want to look for patterns across our entire service and our entire architecture. And something like this helps us with that. So what we do is we look at all the actions, and then we prioritize using this framework, impact and probability. So probability is we say, what is the chance of this happening again? Is it very high? Is it medium? Is it low? And then we put some numbers against that. And the other dimension is impact. If this were to happen again, what would be the impact? Would it be very severe? Would it be high, medium, low? And based on that, we come up with a ranking. So if something that's ranked like, you know, very high on the probability and very high on the impact is obviously a very high priority thing for a team to go fix. And so there is a problem management report. It keeps track of what actions have been closed, how they are aging, how many weeks they've been active, et cetera. And this becomes a kind of a scorecard for the team. All right, so now shifting gear. So I described sort of our entire lifecycle processes. I want to talk a little bit about how we do security. Now, this is a big topic. You know, it will take an hour for me to just cover security, but I'm not going to do that. I'm just going to give you a sense of how we do this thing. We have at Microsoft, we have a central team called Trustworthy Computing. This team was established, you know, 10-plus years ago, and they have a number of experts deep in the security practices and policies, and they define security practices for the entire company, you know, how you should do secure development, how you should do secure operation, and we take all those recommendations and we implement it. So we just inherit from all that goodness that come out of a central team. Now the practices have evolved over time, clearly, as we learn about new threats and new patterns. The biggest evolution that I've seen in the recent months or recent years, rather, is this mindset that the idea is not to prevent a breach. The idea is that assume the breach has already happened. Meaning, your corporate network environment is already breached. You probably have a credential that's already leaked, or probably somebody has stolen it. And so assume that's going to happen, or that's already happened. What are you going to do to deal with that? How are you going to detect that problem? How are you going to isolate that problem? How are you going to mitigate that problem? How are you going to recover from that problem, et cetera? So that's the biggest mindset shift that we have in the company now and in our team also. So the wheel shows sort of the 10 different types of security threats that we look at, and we categorize them into these buckets. So like data protection is about, you know, what I mentioned earlier, like, you know, if you have a disaster, you lose data, how do you recover from it? That, you know, giving guarantee to customer that if you give us your data, we'll keep it safe. We'll make it available to you all the time. The service availability is kind of keeping service available all the time so the customer have access to the data that they have. Service security is making sure that we don't accidentally leak that information either over network or somebody steals a credential and leaks it from us or credential gets stolen. And then the last thing is the data privacy, which is privacy. Privacy is making sure that we don't abuse the rights we have to your data. So let me give you one example of how we do security, and this is called secrets management. In a lifecycle environment, you have lots of secrets, and secrets are things like your passwords, your certificates, your storage keys, service accounts. The in a distributed environment, you have hundreds of them. And for our Visual Studio Online, we have well over 1,000 secrets, almost 2,000. So the problem with the secret is that there are a number of issues. First of all, they expire. Each secret has an expiry date. And you got 2,000 of them, so they're expiring all the time. And so when they expire, and if you haven't rotated a secret, guess what? Bad things happen. In fact, there is an example of an outage we had where is SSL cert expired on Azure storage. And as a company, we had almost 9 hours of outage. It took down so many services across the company. So we should never let a secret expire. That's sort of rule number one. The other thing is secret may get leaked. Accidentally may get leaked. Like a developer may put some information in the error code by accident and gets leaked, or may get passed. Some secret may get passed around in free text. During operations, so things like that can happen. Or secret may get stolen. Somebody hacks into your system and may steal a secret. So there are a set of practices we have to avoid this. First is we use this thing called Azure Secret Store. So all the secrets that we have, they're stored in a secret store encrypted. So nobody has access to the secrets in plain text. The second thing is we have this thing called expiring object scanner. So first of all, secret store reminds us of expiring objects, expiring secrets. So we can go and rotate those secrets well in advance. But in addition, we run a scanner in our production environment that goes and looks at all the nodes and make sure that all the certificates are not about to expire or already expired. And finally, we rotate secrets all the time. So we rotate them on a regular basis as well as on an episodic basis. So when somebody leaves the team, we go and rotate the secrets because we concern that somebody who's leaving the team may walk away with the secret. When I say somebody who had previous access to the secrets in our service delivery team. So this is just an example of one of the security practices that we have. But like I said, security is a very big topic, and I frankly cannot do the justice in 5 or 10 minutes. So that brings me to my last slide, and that's about the culture. A lot of what I already talked about, I already mentioned live site first, number one priority for the team. We are never confused about that. Second one is feel the pain. This is putting our engineers in front of the live site, in front of that DRI call, because when they feel the pain, they are likely to take the right action of preventing that issue from happening again versus just applying a Band-Aid. Being very data-driven means that it's not just about collecting a lot of data, but being able to get right insight out of the data, create right visualization of the data. So that's very much seeped into our culture. Automation is your friend. When I mentioned, you're dealing with issues that need to be dealt with in minutes. So automating things like communication, auto dumper, everything that you can automate, if you get humans out of the way, is the way to go. And finally, openness. This is sort of accountability without fear and this mindset of continuous improvement. It's not about passing blame, being overly critical of the team. It's always about what can we learn when something goes wrong, how can we get better, and having a notion of accountability with fear. So that's the last, but certainly not the least of the values we hold importance to in the culture. So that brings me to the end of my talk. Thank you very much. Hope this was helpful. I'm around if there are more questions after this. I don't know if you have time, or is it already an hour? Oh, out of time. All right. Okay. Thank you.